Mystical dimensions, near-death experiences. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Marilyn Schlitz back with us, PhD, social anthropologist, writer, speaker, has been a leader in the field of consciousness studies for more than three decades. Dr. Schlitz serves as a president emeritus and a senior fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. That's the late Edgar Mitchell's Foundation. And her latest work, Death Makes Life Possible, Revolutionary Insights on Living, Dying, and the Continuation of Consciousness. And Marilyn, welcome back. Good to have you again.
Thank you, George. It's great to be here.
And how are you? What's new?
I'm good. It's been a wild ride. I think that we're living in extraordinary times,
as you know.
Oh, my gosh.
We sure are.
And just trying to keep balance and stay on the cutting edge.
How did you end up doing what you're doing? How did that all happen?
Well, it started when I was a rebellious kid in Detroit and feeling like I wanted to change the world, but had no way to do that. And I had a couple of experiences. Started with being somewhere I shouldn't have been with somebody I shouldn't have been with. Closing time at the bar on the back of a motorcycle, and we got hit by a drunk driver.
Oh.
Threw my body off the motorcycle, and I had a real physical, tangible, out-of-body experience and watched my body tumbling through the air, landing on the concrete. And I think there was something in that moment that suggested, anyway, that consciousness is more than just our physical being. And then I went home to heal, and they had talked about possibly amputating my leg. And I laid there, and I used my imagination to visualize my immune system healing me. And I was, you know, really aware of the tingles up my leg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I have two sturdy legs, and I think
good.
That consciousness is something powerful.
And we're going to talk about you, your first experience, near-death experience. You were just a year and a half old, weren't you?
Oh, that's true. I was wandering around my family's house in my cute pink jammies and being a good empiricist, which means you investigate everything.
Did you have those little feet pajamas?
I think so. I don't really remember the moment, honestly, but I've heard tales. And anyway, my father had inadvertently left a can of lighter fluid sitting on the kitchen table.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, I did what good 18-month-old kids do, and I put it in my mouth, and I ended up in and out of intensive care.
Oh, you drank it?
I drank it, and it caused, you know, massive pneumonia, and almost didn't make it. So I think that there were some seeds planted then, too, that got me on this path of wanting to understand consciousness.
Somebody wants you around.
I guess that's a nice way to think about it.
You do know I was born in Detroit and raised there and left there when I was 28 years old.
I think I knew that, but I didn't remember until now. So tell me, where was that?
I was born in the city, and then we ended up moving to Dearborn Heights, where we spent most of my childhood. And then my first places, I was in Taylor, Michigan, Farmington Hills, and then worked at all three television stations in Detroit, 2, 4, and 7. And then in 1979, I moved to 1978, I moved to Minneapolis, and 1979, I moved to St. Louis, and now I'm back and forth between St. Louis and Los Angeles. How about
wow.
you?
Well, I was right in Detroit, right near City Airport, and it was about the time I figured out I could leave that I left. And, you know, I still have a lot of nostalgia for Detroit and a lot of admiration for the people that are trying to make a difference there.
Family still there?
I have some family. They moved out to Harrison Township, where I had my motorcycle accident was
uh-huh.
Dearborn Heights.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, if you tell me where, because you must remember the street.
Oh, I don't.
Was it a busy street?
Yeah, it was a busy street, but it was late, and I think the trauma kind of overrode.
I'm gonna close my eyes and guess.
Do a remote viewing now.
That you were on Telegraph Road.
That sounds about right.
Near Michigan.
How's your remote viewing skill?
Near Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I can't remember exactly to say for sure, but I'm sure there's records of it somewhere.
Well, good thing you're back here. My gosh.
Yeah, well, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
So did this all really steer you in the direction where you are now? I mean, you've got a PhD in social anthropology. You've just been elected a vice president of the Parapsychological Association. We'll get into that. But is this what laid the foundation for you?
Well, I think it really started when I got to Wayne State University in downtown Detroit, which you'll remember.
I do. And I went to the University of Detroit.
Good one. Oh, really? So that is right downtown.
Yeah.
Well, I discovered two books when I got into college, and the first one was Thomas Kuhn's book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And that book said that we live in a paradigm or a worldview, a kind of social construction of reality, and that that worldview has changed periodically through history. And that was a big empowerment for me because I felt like, well, maybe what we were experiencing in Detroit, this, you know, kind of civil war that was going on, the race war and class war and gender war and ultimately a worldview conflict, I think, that maybe wasn't permanent and maybe wasn't defined by ultimate reality. So that was liberating. And then that led me to the second book, which was Psychic Exploration by Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut.
Mm-hmm. Great guy.
And I didn't apply for the job at Noetic Sciences, but it was about 15 years later that they invited me to come and be their director of research and worked my way up the ladder from there.
Now, you're at Sophia University now?
That's right. We're looking at transpersonal experiences and from a psychological lens.
Now, what is that, transpersonal psychology? What is that?
It's the stuff you're interested in, George. It's all that kind of notion that there are aspects of our experience that transcend the physical, that people can have these kind of altered states or near-death or out-of-body type of experiences, and it doesn't mean it's pathological. It means it may be a catalyst for some big breakthrough to understanding more about who we are and what the nature of reality might be.
We're with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, spelled just like the beer, right?
It is.
Any relationship to the family?
Well, it's, you know, it comes from an old brewery village in Germany, Schlitz, but actually Stroh's Brewery, which you'll remember.
I remember that from Detroit.
Schlitz, yeah. And so the beer that made Milwaukee famous actually is now a Detroit beer, at least the last time I checked.
Do they still call it Schlitz beer?
You know, I don't know.
Did it get gobbled up? It's been a long time.
I'm sure, right. All the microbreweries have taken over.
What have you learned about near-death experiences, about the other side? What can you conclude at this point?
Well, I know that culture takes a big role in defining what we experience. So if we're told our entire life through our educational system and our families, our work environment, that the only real valid reality is the physical, you know, that which we can measure and manipulate and touch and taste, then that's usually what we see. And if we are brought up in a worldview or a culture that accepts extended realms of possibility, then we're more likely to perceive those realms of possibility. And some of it may be a cultural construction, but I also believe very definitely that there are more aspects of our human experience than just our physical embodiment.
And if people can tap into this and use it in their living life, I think they can do some remarkable things with that, don't you?
I really do. I think that if we start to own the power of our intention, you know, the fact that intention is a very important principle. So from the morning when we get out of bed and we intend to, you know, make a path or a plan going forward, that's an expression of intention. And then what about those big intentions where we want to achieve something, you know, beyond our normal capacity? That becomes a tremendous empowerment. And so to the extent we can begin to cultivate these abilities, I think the more we'll be able to accomplish those dreams that many of us have.
Have you come across anything that still baffles you, Maryland?
Every day more and more. I think there's just so many mysteries. And again, you think about what these different cultures expect from the world. And, you know, being in the Amazon, for example, I spent some time with the Achuar in Ecuador. And, you know, they really do believe that at night their consciousness leaves the body when they're dreaming, and that they are having direct contact with the spirit world. So they go out and they get information, and then they come back, and in the morning when they wake up, it's like if we were to read the newspaper in the morning and see what happened in the world while we were sleeping, they use their dreams to help navigate what they're going to do in the course of a day. And so it's like a precognitive experience and a whole culture built around that. And I think that's pretty extraordinary. They also make use of plant medicines. The ayahuasca, for example,
Sure.
Something that they use for big visions. So if they want to anticipate what the whole group should do 20 years from now, they'll use the ayahuasca in a collective ritual. And that includes little kids, you know, seniors, everybody in the whole sort of community participates.
Do these experiences make you more aware of the possibility of God, or does it take you the other way?
I guess it's a matter of definition. How do we define God? I think that the idea that there is something beyond this limited awareness, this encapsulated mind-body that connects us to other mind bodies, suggests something vast. And I also think, you know, people who are able to access these non-ordinary states of consciousness experience depths of reality that aren't part of our mundane, everyday experience. And that's, you know, pretty mind-altering.
We are going to get into a lot of different aspects of really the supernatural and the spiritual, reincarnation and things like that. And you've got some great stories about reincarnation. The book that you wrote back in 2015, Death Makes Life Possible. Tell me about that title again. How did you come up with that?
Well, I'd like to say I did, but I was working in partnership with Deepak Chopra for a film. We made a feature-length documentary by that title, and he was the one that I was giving a lecture at one of his workshops, and I was showing a little video that I had done with some of the scientists who are working in this area of, you know, after-death, reincarnation. And he pulled me aside after I was done, and he's like, Marilyn, let's make a movie. And I thought, well, who wouldn't want to make a movie with Deepak Chopra? And then I went to bed that night, and I woke up the next morning completely petrified, you know, the whole idea of having to fundraise and all the rest of it. And so at lunch, I thanked him very profusely and explained that I really wasn't going to be able to do it. And he said, oh, Marilyn, stop worrying about the money. The money will come. And I'd like to say it was just that easy, but we did accomplish something that now has been all over the world, translated into multiple languages, and aired on Oprah about 2 years ago. So it's been out there and making an impact with people who are struggling. Our goal in both the film and the book was to help transform that fear that people have into an inspiration for really living well.
I mean, I always tell people I'm not in a hurry to leave, but I'm not scared if we have to do it.
Right. And we will eventually, although the world, that's a whole interesting thing, too, in terms of future science. You know, we see now that all this cloning is happening. They've just cloned eggs that can be fertilized to turn into humans in a Petri dish.
That's crazy.
It's amazing. It's truly spectacular.
If they learn how to download memory and preserve it on a chip, let's say, and then clone your body and then put your memory into that body, we live forever.
Yeah, that may be how we get life on Mars or future beyond that, is that it's going to come with, you know, some kind of genetic manipulation and cloning. And, you know, it may not be that this physical body goes out into space, but that it's generations later through these kind of scientific interventions that we start to see the future of humanity.
What do you say to people, Marilyn, who say, hogwash, life after death does not continue? When we die, that's it. It's over. What do you say to them?
Well, I'm very respectful that people have various different perspectives, different worldviews, and my inclination is to think that what we really believe is probably what we're going to end up in. So those people who believe in reincarnation may well reincarnate, and those people who believe in sort of the Buddhist journey of enlightenment may end up in a, you know, maybe in a black hole somewhere, you know, alternating at the threshold of some event horizon. I mean, I think all of those things that seemed completely far-fetched in the past are now something that we can really start to grapple with. When I made the film, I interviewed Michael Shermer, who is, you know,
he's the skeptic. He's the skeptic.
Well-known skeptic. He's also, you know, a really smart guy, very interesting.
And a nice guy. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, I would say so. And I had a really great time interviewing him. And what was fascinating, there were two things. First of all, he acknowledged that when his mom died, he heard her voice. And I, you know, was a little surprised that he was telling me this on film. And I said, well, really, let's, you know, go back to that. And he said, oh, well, you know, it was really nothing. But yeah, I heard her voice. And I thought, well, that's an interesting acknowledgement. And he had a good psychological justification. It was just some kind of hypnagogic experience right at that threshold of sleep and dreaming. But it was interesting that he acknowledged it. And then the second thing that I really loved was that he got married shortly after my interviewing him. And I guess they got married in either his house or his now wife's house, and her father or grandfather, I can't remember the details exactly, but had left her a radio, and it didn't work, and Michael had tried and tried to fix it, and eventually, in frustration, he stuck the radio in a drawer and didn't think about it anymore, and then months later, they were having their wedding ceremony. And in the middle of the ceremony, all of a sudden they start hearing music playing. And they proceeded to complete the ceremony and went in and followed the music, and it was that radio. And his wife was quite convinced that this had something to do with her departed loved one. Michael wrote a column in Scientific American where he started to play with the idea that maybe this was something more. And his colleagues came down so hard on him that he retracted any kind of open-mindedness and went back to his kind of entrenched position of skepticism.
Well, what's important, too, is a skeptic is not a non-believer. A skeptic wants proof.
Right. I mean, it comes from the ancient Greek, where it was the dogmatists were the people who really understood and knew, and the skeptics were the ones who were questioning. It wasn't like they denied the existence of these things, but they wanted to raise questions. And I think that's different than a debunker.
I think so, too. And I also think it's healthy to be skeptical until you get the proof.
I do, too. I think open-minded skepticism is the healthiest perspective we can have. We're in agreement on that. It must be our Detroit impulses.
You got it. Marilyn, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about your work. In our final hour, next hour, we'll take phone calls about this. But I also want you, when we come back, to talk about this story of reincarnation, about a little child that was born with three birthmarks. And we'll talk about that. It's an amazing story. So many more. Dr. Marilyn Schlitz with us. Her website is her name. And we've got it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. That makes it really easy. We will take your calls next hour with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, author of Death Makes Life Possible, also Consciousness and Healing as well. And Marilyn, would you tell us the story of the reincarnation of the little child?
Well, there's so many stories. Let's
this one had take a step. Birthmarks or something like that.
Right. Well, Ian Stevenson was a very unusual psychiatrist who developed a very strong interest in trying to document cases of reincarnation. And he collected about 1,000 case studies of young children who had had some experience of a past life that they reported to their family. He went in and investigated, did corroborating evidence, interviewed people, read medical reports, And in about 35% of the people that he identified, they had some kind of unusual birthmark. So it's not a typical mole, but some kind of unusual birthmark. And it was often associated with the cause of death of the person that the young child remembered. So there were numerous examples where, for instance, one child remembered being a man from a different village in Asia, and he, Ian Stevenson, then went and investigated the biography of this person that the child remembered being, and it turns out that that person was shot through the chest in the same place, entry and exit, where the bullet ostensibly went through the body. And so that becomes a kind of biological source of evidence for reincarnation in these young people. You know, it's not absolutely evident, but or evidential, but it's still compelling. In our film, we interviewed Jim Tucker, who now works in the same institute at the University of Virginia that Ian Stevenson had founded. And he tells the story of a young boy who, you know, very early, just about the time he learned to speak, remembered being his grandfather. And he would tell his dad, when his dad was changing his diapers, I used to change your diapers when you were little. And it was kind of shocking for these parents.
To hear that, sure.
And then this kid started remembering other things about the kind of car that he used to drive. And so as a little test, the parents got a bunch of pictures from the dad. And first of all, they had a class picture when he was in elementary school. And so this would be the child's grandfather. And they asked him to pick out which one was him, and he had no problem finding himself in the lineup. And then they were going through some of the other snapshots, and he saw his car. And he said, "That's my car. That's my car. I used to drive that car." And so, again, it's not definitive evidence that there is a kind of survival of consciousness or identity after bodily death. But these instances give us really compelling ideas about what is possible.
It's truly remarkable. And remember the case study of the little boy who claimed that he was a World War II pilot? And he knew things about the plane. When it landed too hard, the tires would blow up. And really nobody knew that other than the crew and the pilot. And he was telling his parents this, and they got that verified, and they took him to a reunion of World War II veterans, and he knew several of the people from his unit. It was an amazing story. Do you remember that case?
I'm vaguely remembering it. I don't remember the details of it, but I think you're right. These things are phenomenally intriguing, and it's very exciting. I know that the University of Virginia right now is hiring a postdoc to work part-time with them and part-time at the Monroe Institute to do some psychophysiological research on this. We're right now setting up a lab here at SOFIA to look at the psychomantium. This was a technique that was used by the ancient oracles in Greece.
Yes.
And they ostensibly were able to identify and communicate with spirits by looking at or gazing upon a reflective surface. And Raymond Moody developed this protocol where he put people in a darkened room, put a mirror on the wall, illuminated the mirror in such a way that you couldn't see your own reflection, but because you're kind of going into a trance state, people start to see things and hear things and experience things. And, you know, there have been a number of experiments looking at people's ability to make contact with their departed loved ones and to have those kind of conversations that they never had a chance to have. And it has been shown to be extremely useful for bereavement counseling. So people have an opportunity to have the conversation. They can see it. They can see the spirits. And so what we're doing now is bringing that idea into a virtual reality environment. So we'll have people sitting with the virtual reality goggles, looking at a mirror in a sensory deprivation procedure, and we're going to record and try to understand what it is that people are experiencing when they enter that state.
One of our very special guests, author and researcher Rosemary Ellen Guiley, uses black mirrors to do a lot of this. It's
exactly.
It's really strange. But
well,
it
I'd be interested in talking to her. Yeah.
Yeah, just deal with Tom, if you would, Marilyn,
okay.
And he'll
yeah.
He'll get you in touch with her. Her website is visionaryliving.com. You might be able to email her straight through there.
Okay. But what you're saying, even that title for a website, is really not so much about what happens after, but how those ideas and beliefs inform how we live now. And, you know, we know that people believe different things, even within a common culture. All we have to do is look at the political debate that's happening right now to know that people justify their beliefs based on different kinds of evidence. And while in our culture we tend to hold in esteem the idea of rationality, about reason, about the idea of objectivity, we make appeals that if we have good objective data, that then is the evidence that's going to shape our belief. But what we see is that it's most often something else. It's most often a personal, direct experience, something emotional or transformative. And that's what really shapes our belief, and then we just rationalize the rest of it in the name of objective data.
Absolutely. Our special guest, Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, we're talking about really things dealing with consciousness and the other side. How many people who believe in life after death also believe in God? What do you think the percent is, Marilyn?
I think it's a tricky question.
Of course,
again,
it came from me.
And I love that about you, George. I think that it really depends on what people believe going into it and what they define God to be. For example, in the Christian tradition, there can be a lot of fear of, you know, the afterlife, because it can be met with, you know,
As long as, and if hell is involved, of course.
Right. Hell and damnation.
Mm-hmm.
And those can be very, very scary. Whereas if you're coming from a Buddhist tradition, where there isn't a God per se, but there's this idea of, you know, consciousness is the ground of all being. So in a certain sense, consciousness becomes God. That can be a much more beautiful journey towards something that allows us a sense of safety and hope, optimism. So I think, you know, those preconditions that shape what our culture tells us is true can very much influence how we think about the afterlife and how we hold our relationship to the divine.
You talk about the denial about death that so many people have. Why do they? What are they afraid of?
I think we as human beings are hardwired to be afraid of uncertainty. And because we don't definitively know, it becomes a scary prospect. And I think people will go to great extremes in order to buffer that terror that people have. There's a really fascinating area of social psychology called terror management theory that was developed out of the work of Ernest Becker, who wrote that great book, Denial of Death. And they have found that if people are, you know, functioning in a normal way and they get triggered by some reminder of their mortality, it can lead to very pathological types of behaviors. But if you can bolster their sense of personal worth, their value in the world, and you enhance their self-esteem, you'll see that when you trigger them, they actually become more altruistic. They care about other people. So I think if we can approach this idea of death and the great mystery of it with an open heart and that kind of skepticism that is productive, I think it can become a great exploration and a wonderful adventure for people.
It probably could. When did you know Edgar Mitchell before he
I
passed on?
do. Yeah, very well.
Great
I
guy.
worked with him for years. Wonderful person.
Yep.
Edgar said in the interview I did with him for Death Makes Life Possible that, I was really interested in his story because he was a person who had been fighting in Korea. He had been a test pilot, and he talked about, being on those aircraft carriers where when they would go off on a mission and then they had to come back and find the aircraft carrier in the middle of the ocean, it was like a needle in a haystack. And so for him, that was a scary moment. When he got in the Apollo capsule and went to the moon, he said, there was plenty of space on the moon and it was hard to find. But his thing that he said that I thought was so wise is that he felt it was much more important to live a good life and to be a good citizen, to be loving and kind toward other people, than it was to spend a lot of time worrying about what's going to happen next. And I just thought that's, it's a powerful notion, and he was a great man.
Is there definitive evidence to prove that there's life after death? If you were in a court of law and this was challenged, death was challenged, could you prove that there's life after death?
So this would make a great reality show.
It
I would love.
really is in a courtroom.
Let's do it. I want to do it. So you have a judge and a jury, and you have people representing different points of view on controversial topics. So take this one, life after death, and you have these people arguing their various positions.
With witnesses that come and go.
Exactly, giving their own personal testimony based on their experiences.
Wheel in a corpse, put it right
And
there.
then you get into this question of what would shift people's mind about that question? And is it the data? Is it the fact that Ian Stevenson collected these, nearly 1,000 cases and showed that 35% of them correlated with the birthmarks? Is that what's going to persuade people? Or is it the personal experiences that somebody's reporting? I had a conversation with my departed dad, and he told me to go to this closet and find something. That's really persuasive for people, much more than accumulating a lot of data, I think.
I think so too. Dr. Marilyn Schlitz with us. We're going to take phone calls next hour about life after death. Let's talk a little bit, Marilyn, in the time we have remaining here, about consciousness and how important it plays and its role that it plays with all of this. What would you, first of all, say consciousness is?
Well, I think, again, we can have many definitions. For me, it's been about our awareness and also our lack of awareness of what we're not aware of. So by that, I mean, when I first talked about Thomas Kuhn's book on paradigm shifts, we live in a paradigm or a worldview. And the interesting thing to me about worldviews is that we don't even know that we have them. And yet, they're the most important thing that shapes our experience. So it's like we're walking through life with these colored glasses on, and it shapes our experiences. And so we can't see those things that lie outside of our expectations. And I think part of the process of becoming aware is becoming aware that we're not aware. And that we have what's called inattentional blindness, for example. We are primed to perceive those parts of the world that we expect to see. And if we don't expect to see them, we simply don't see them. And I think that that is a remarkable aspect of what our consciousness is all about. It's a lot of it functioning on autopilot at the unconscious level. And to the extent we can, turn the light on what those experiences are and what shapes our awareness, where are we placing our attention, that then offers us a point of liberation into expanding what we understand to be true.
Do you believe that consciousness lives outside of the brain?
I do. I think consciousness is something that has intelligence. It is self-correcting. It is reflective. And so you can go into a rainforest and see that as consciousness manifest in the forest, because every nook and cranny is filled with life and with that intention to manifest life. And so I do believe that consciousness is something much bigger than our individual brain. I don't think it's an epiphenomenon of the brain. And at the same time, I think the brain is kind of like, you know, the radio that is taking the signal in. So if you destroy the brain, you may destroy the radio. It doesn't mean you've destroyed the consciousness.
Or the signal.
Or the signal, exactly.
It keeps coming. Exactly. Will science ever meet the spiritual side of all of this?
I think so. I mean, I think we're getting closer and closer all the time. I just spent time with Sophia, the android. She's a robot.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Her. Yeah, she'd be great for you to interview and see if they would do it in a way that doesn't give...
They may want her as a talk show host if she's any good, huh?
Don't worry. You're nobody better than you, George.
We're coming back with phone calls, your calls, next on Coast to Coast AM.